This show is a proud member of the Pride 48 Podcasting Network. Check out other great podcasts at pride48.com/shows.
Welcome to the North and South of Things podcast, a show dedicated to discussion of topics important to the LGBT community and the community at large. Here are your hosts, Mark and George. Hey kids, welcome back to the North and South of Things. This is George in Atlanta, and I'm joined by...
I am Mark here in St. Paul, and we got a very cloudy, very late fall-like post first winter storm here in St. Paul.
It's a lovely sunny day here, but it's cold. So cold, I'm making chicken tequila soup.
Oh, my.
Oh, wait. I just inadvertently and possibly Freudianly said chicken tequila soup. I meant chicken tortilla soup.
Well, I don't know about you, George, but I've been drinking more than I probably should lately.
With good reason. With good reason. Kids, that's what we're going to talk about today. We want to talk a little bit about a postmortem on the campaign, what went wrong, what can we improve upon, and what do we need to do moving forward. Mark, I suppose we should start right with the results.
Right. Well, Donald Trump won the Electoral College.
Okay, we're done. Thanks with that. No, just kidding. Now, did he?
Well, that's a question, but I want to start out by saying he did not win the popular vote. Let's make that very, very clear. The popular vote went to Hillary Clinton. It did not go to Donald Trump.
For the fourth time in our nation's history and the second time since 2000, which is stunning, given the other two times happened in the 1800s. It is stunning. She has a 1.3 million lead at the moment. I think there are still votes being counted in California, and I want to say Michigan, and is it Oregon? I'm not sure which all, but I know there's at least two states, and California being one of them, that votes are still being tallied. So that 1.3 million, it has been suggested, could be upwards of 2 million. I'd probably put it at 1.5, but... pretty stunning. We have a national population of what, 350 million?
Yeah, something like that.
And take from that the voting age. So, I mean, people who are of voting age and are registered voters, 1.3 million. It's pretty interesting. And quite frankly, Mark, I was on a cruise when all of this went down, right?
That's right.
So I was in Mexico. I was in, that was Tuesday, so we were in Mazatlan, and we intentionally did not watch any of the returns. We were celebrating the 50th birthday of my friend Joey, and so we didn't watch anything throughout the day or the evening. We had a special dinner planned on the ship's steakhouse, so we wanted to honor his birthday. We are all Democrats. We all were voting for Hillary and supporting Hillary. Not everyone agrees 100% in my little group that Hillary... some have some differing opinions about her, but largely we're of the opinion that she should be president. So we were a little shocked toward the end of the evening to learn what was happening. We didn't sort of watch the returns, but we saw enough posts on Facebook and our quick glances to realize we were going to have a pretty sad Wednesday. It's interesting to me, Mark, that the battleground states were not quite as... it's deceptive when you look at this national map and, right, it's all red.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's deceptive because it's really not red. Georgia, I want to talk about Georgia for a minute. The state of Georgia, which has 16 electoral college votes, Donald Trump won by less than 200,000 votes. And you may say that's a lot of votes, George. It's a pretty decisive win. Well, I mean, yeah, but we had nearly, I think, 4.2 million votes cast in Georgia.
George, did you look at the breakdown of anyone that was voting third party or any blank votes? Do you get that kind of information in Georgia?
Not on the blank. The third party that I've seen, Jill Stein didn't get much attention at all. Gary Johnson got 3% of the vote. He got 123,000, which would have come a long way. I'm not saying people who voted for Johnson would have voted for Hillary necessarily. Some might not. But that would have put her much closer to, I mean, we're talking Georgia, deep South,
right.
Clay, you know, Republican
right.
held, all our governor is Republican, our House is Republican, our Senate is Republican, and has been for the last 5 or 6 years now. So it's not like Texas, right? Texas, Trump won by 800,000 there, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I think it might have actually been a little more than 800,000, but I mean, Texas is not Georgia. And that's important to note, that what we heard, which we'll talk about in a little bit, what we heard about some of these battleground states changing in demographics, I think they did. Mark, how did your state do?
Well, we actually lead the nation in voter turnout and have for quite some time. During this election, we had 74.2% of eligible voters turn out to vote, which was about 2.9 million. Now, it's interesting, and actually our governor here in Minnesota had made a comment not too long after the election, because the number of eligible voters turning out is actually falling in Minnesota. And it's a trend that goes back, to prior elections. So during this one, you said, well, 74.2%. Well, that's amazing. That's mm-hmm. fantastic. But the previous one was 76.4%. And the election prior to that was at 78%.
Wow, that's remarkable.
Of eligible voters are turning out to cast their votes.
So what's happening?
So this is
voter suppression?
I think part of that is, I think it's apathy, mm-hmm. really. I think people are more and more disenfranchised with political gridlock in Washington. You've got a lot of money for lobbying interests, and it's like the elected representatives are not listening to their constituents. I know I have been frustrated with that lately, mm-hmm. Contacting my representatives and not hearing a response from them.
Mark, is your state, tell us about your governor and your state legislature. Are they Democrat or Republican or mixed?
Well, the governor is a Democrat. We lost both the House and the Senate here, so now they're both in Republican hands. Mm-hmm. It hasn't always been that way. We had a huge deficit, which our governor basically turned around doing the same kinds of things that Obama had done on a national level. And, you know, we have some of the strongest job growth in the country.
Right.
And so you do have, it's a solidly Democratic process that is happening here. But the problem is now we have some of the same sort of Republican obstructionist behaviors that are happening. And given the last two legislative sessions, literally nothing has gotten done.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, infrastructure continues to decline.
Investments in job growth and
exactly. Yeah. So all of this is, playing out on a state level, you know, it's the microcosm, macrocosm kind of argument that you have there.
Mm-hmm. So while Minnesota, your fair state, leads the nation in voter turnout, Hawaii, I find it interesting, the birthplace of President Obama, has the worst voter turnout.
And what's that number?
42.5%. And it was only, frankly, 2% higher the last election when Obama was running. You would think that your home state would spike in its turnout, and mm-hmm. it was only 2% higher, and I believe it was still the lowest in the nation. But to be sure, I mean, Georgia had 60%. The national average is 58.4. So not a horrible year for voter turnout, but when you see that graphic that we've all seen now, right, showing what 45 million Americans mm-hmm. didn't vote, who could have voted? Yeah, I mean, it kicks you right in the gut. You know, so the Electoral College, Mark, with your permission, I'd love to play the audio from a YouTube video and beg the indulgence of our listeners. It is about 6 minutes long. But it is an explainer that talks about the trouble with the Electoral College. Are you okay with that?
Yeah, I'm fine. Go ahead, hit it.
In a fair democracy, everyone's vote should count equally. But the method that the United States uses to elect its president, called the Electoral College, violates this principle by making sure that some people's votes are more equal than others. The Electoral College is, essentially, the 538 votes that determine who wins the presidency. If these votes were split evenly across the population, every 574,000 people would be represented by one vote. But that's not what happens because the Electoral College doesn't give votes to people, only states, which has some unfair consequences. For example, there are 11.5 million people in Ohio, so, to fairly represent them, it should get 20 electoral votes. But the Electoral College doesn't give Ohio 20 votes, it only gets 18, two less than it should. Where those other votes go? To states like Rhode Island. Plucky Rhode Island has 1.1 million people in it, so it should have about two votes, but instead it gets four. Those extra two votes that should be representing Ohioans go to representing Rhode Islanders instead. Why? Because, according to the rules of the Electoral College, every state, no matter how few people live there, gets three votes to start with before the rest are distributed according to population. Because of this rule, there are a lot of states with a few people that should only have one or two votes for president, but instead get three or four. So Georgians, Virginians, Michiganders, and Jerseyites are each missing one vote. Pennsylvanians, North Carolinians, Ohioans, and Hoosiers are missing two, Floridians are missing four, New Yorkers five, Texans six, and Californians are 10 votes short of what they should get. Because of this vote redistribution, the Electoral College essentially pretends that fewer people live where they do and more people live where they don't. An American who lives in one of these states has their vote for president count for less than an American who lives in one of these states. In some cases, the Electoral College bends the results just a little, but if you live in a particularly large or small state, it bends them a lot. One Vermonter's vote, according to the Electoral College, is worth three Texans' votes, and one Wyomingite's vote is worth four Californians'. Now, whoa, hold on there, son, you might be saying to yourself right now. You're missing the whole point of the Electoral College. It's to protect the small states from the big states. Give the small states more voting power, and the presidential candidates will have to pay them more attention in an election. If that's the goal of the Electoral College, it's failing spectacularly. Here's a graph showing the number of visits the presidential candidates paid to each of the states in the last 2 months of the previous election. If it looks like there are a few states missing, you're right. Only 18 of the 50 states received even a single visit from a candidate, and just two of those states, Maine and New Hampshire, have very small populations. The area of the country with the most small states is conspicuously missing. The Electoral College doesn't make candidates care about small states. But interestingly, the biggest states, California, Texas, and New York, are missing as well. So what's going on? Looking closer, just four states, Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, received a majority of the candidates' attention during the election. And if you follow the money, it's the same story. Why do candidates spend so much money and time in so few states? Because the way the Electoral College works forces them to do so. The elections are winner-take-all. As long as a candidate gets just over 50% of the popular vote in a state, he wins 100% of that state's electoral votes. That means winning by millions of citizens' votes is no better than winning by a single vote, so candidates are safe to ignore states where they poll with big margins. Instead, the Electoral College makes candidates intensely interested in the needs of just a few states with close races to the detriment of almost all Americans, which is why it should be abolished. But wait, you might say, won't abolishing the Electoral College and voting directly for president cause candidates to spend all their time in big cities? That wouldn't be fair to most Americans either. This sounds like a reasonable fear, but ignores the mathematical reality of population distribution. There are 309 million people in the United States, only 8 million of which live in New York, the largest city by far. That's 2.6% of the total population. But after New York, the size of cities drops fast. LA has 3.8 million people, and Chicago has 2.7. But you can't even make it to the 10th biggest city, San Jose, before you're under a million people. These top 10 cities added together are only 7.9% of the popular vote, hardly enough to win an election. And even winning the next 90 biggest cities in the United States all the way down to Spokane is still not yet 20% of the total population. So unless there's a city with a few hundred million people hiding somewhere in America that's been left out of the census, the idea that a candidate can just spend their campaign jetting between New York, LA, and Chicago while ignoring everyone else and still become president is mathematically ludicrous. Want to see the real way to unfairly win? How you can become president with only 22% of the popular vote by taking advantage of the Electoral College today. Don't believe that's possible in a democracy? Just watch. Here's the action plan. Win the votes of the people who count the most and ignore the people who count the least. Start with Wyoming, the state where 0.18% of Americans live, but who get 0.56% of the Electoral College votes for president. And, because it's a winner-take-all system, you don't need all of them to vote for you, just half plus one, or 0.09%. Next up is the District of Columbia, where winning 0.1% of the population gets you an additional 0.56% of the Electoral College. Then add in wins in Vermont and North Dakota and Alaska. Notice how the votes you're getting to win the presidency go up much faster than the percent of the population who voted for you because of the Electoral College's rules. Next is South Dakota, then Delaware, Montana, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Maine, Hawaii, Idaho, Nebraska, West Virginia, New Mexico, Nevada, Utah, Kansas, Arkansas, Mississippi, Iowa, Connecticut, Oklahoma, Oregon, Kentucky, Louisiana, South Carolina, Alabama, Colorado, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Maryland, Missouri, Tennessee, Arizona, Indiana, Massachusetts, Virginia, and New Jersey. Congratulations! By taking advantage of the unfair rules and winning states, not people, you've won a majority in the Electoral College even though 78% of the population voted against you. This is not democracy. This is indefensible. While this particular scenario is unlikely, if you have a voting system that allows losers to win, you shouldn't be surprised when they do. Not once, not twice, but thrice in American history, the candidate with the most votes from the people actually lost because of the Electoral College. Three errors in 55-plus elections is a failure rate of 5%. Would anyone tolerate a sport where, by a quirk of the rules, there was a 5% chance that the loser would win? Not likely. Given how much more important electing the President of the United States is, that's a rather dangerously high percentage of the time to get it wrong. If we abolish the Electoral College and simply let citizens vote for the President directly, all of these problems will go away, and everyone's vote will be equal.
So,
yeah, so if Jimmy has five apples and Nancy has three oranges, if they combine them together, how many pineapples do they have?
Exactly. So, I mean, in that, and I do apologize because it's helpful to watch the video on YouTube while listening to the guy, and he made references to charts on the screen, which our listeners can't see. And I'll put the link to the video in the show notes. But it does bring up some good points, does it not? I mean, the notion of somehow states are electing the president, not people, you know? And I get that the 538 electoral votes are equivalent to the number of people in the House, the number of people in the Senate, plus three electors from the District of Columbia. I get the rhyme and reason. I just don't understand why smaller states, smaller population, should have, I just feel like it should be more population based, you know?
I agree. I think it's time to really address this and to get rid of it. But unfortunately we have the results that we have.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
And we can update that video. It's now four times.
Right, exactly.
This has happened where somebody who did not win the popular vote, and I'm going to say that a lot the next 4 years because I don't want people to forget.
Right. And I at the risk of alienating some friends, I'm going to be reminding folks of who they elected.
Right.
So, speaking of, Mark, how did this happen? How did it, I mean, polls had Clinton. Granted, the shenanigans of FBI Director James Comey, who frankly mm-hmm. should be under investigation for electioneering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 2 days before the election, he announces that more emails are being investigated. As it turns out, the emails weren't even Hillary's emails. Some of them were, in fact, repetitive email or duplicate emails that have already been discovered. But, you know, aside from his shenanigans, how did this happen? How did she
lose? Well, you know, I really think this is going to really give a lot of fodder to political science majors
sure.
out there everywhere. And I think it was a congruence and a convergence of different things. It was like the perfect storm, if you will. And, you know, one of the things that we start out with is lies and distortions. I mean, the role that journalism played in this and the media is just, it's ridiculous because...
Especially the fake news, which has become yeah. a buzzword here. It's been going on. It's, you know, Snopes can only do so much, right?
Right.
But we live in a very suspicious time. We live in, we still, for some reason, live in a time where people see something in print, as it were, on the internet. They believe it, right?
Right.
And we've created this hostility toward government. This has been an issue for me for a couple of decades now. When we started mm-hmm. bashing the media, when we started bashing the press, those two things are the same, I'm sorry. When we started bashing government, like all government, like government is bad. No, there mm-hmm. are bad actors in government, but government in and of itself is not bad, shouldn't be considered bad. You have the responsibility to make it right and hold people accountable. But we've gone down this path, this slippery slope of trust nothing, believe no one, aided by people who intentionally inflame, you know, Sarah Palin's lamestream media. You know, I believe she coined that phrase, didn't she? The lamestream media.
I believe so.
I mean, like, let's continue to put everything that you see in front of you in doubt. Let's continue to, you know, and granted, we should have a healthy amount of, you know, of need to investigate and read and educate ourselves and find out what the mm-hmm. real answers are and read multiple sources and sort of form an opinion based on a lot of, I get that. I totally do.
George, but, that's called critical thinking.
I know. I don't. But the fake news, how did that happen? I mean, so many Americans are on Facebook.
Facebook is really under the microscope now. You know, there was basically people looking at both bipartisan websites, both conservative and Democratic, and looking at the articles that appeared on those pages. And the one figure that comes to mind, top of my thinking, is on the GOP sites, 38% of the articles that were posted were out and outright lies or distortions of fact.
38% of stories on GOP-based sites?
Correct.
Wow.
And, you know, the Democrats weren't much better. I think they were at something, don't quote me on this, but like 26%.
Well, I mean, I have seen instances where Democratic candidates will, you know, like they're instant. I think that there was some reports in the middle of the campaign that showed the number of comments that Trump's making that are outright lies and the number of comments that Hillary's making that are outright lies. I want her to be zero in that category. You don't need to need to exaggerate or make lies. This fool, you know, was telling the story enough. That frustrates me that the Democratic sources were just seemingly slightly less inaccurate.
What's frustrating to me is that people on both sides of the aisle can be presented with something that is a fact. Mm-hmm. It's not an opinion. It's a fact. And they will still repudiate facts.
Yeah.
And I don't understand how a critically thinking person with being presented with fact can turn aside from that and just say it doesn't matter or it's a lie. It's a fact.
Yeah.
You are not entitled to your own facts. You are entitled to your own opinion. But opinions are not facts.
And I do think that's one of the things that the media needs to do a better job of is plainly identifying. First of all, they need to stop blurring the lines between editorial slash opinion and news. And I'll save that for a few minutes, but that's on our agenda. In the same sort of Rubicon of lies and distortion in the same bucket is just this decade after decade of investigations of the Clintons.
And it's been shown that there's nothing there.
I mean, this millions, tens of millions of dollars. There's a good story, and it's from a conservative website, that sort of attempts to assess what has been spent on both the email investigations and the Benghazi investigations. Just those two alone are in excess of $30 million, estimated to be at in excess of $30 million. To say nothing of all these other slash gates that have been investigated. And to your point, nothing. She's been found guilty of nothing. But yet, the appearance... Right, because it doesn't.
It is the appearance of impropriety.
Right, and James Comey, 2 days before the election, adds to that with what? More speculation.
We have this thing called the Hatch Act, and I think we really need to look into that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ridiculous. For those who don't know what the Hatch Act is, it's the Hatch Act of 1939. It's an act to prevent pernicious political activities in the United States from those people who hold posts in the executive branch of the federal government.
So James Comey has violated the Hatch Act, in my opinion.
Yes. There are many legal scholars that have been saying that he really should be brought up on charges for this.
And nobody's talking about that in terms of bringing him up. Like, I'm not hearing a word about that. And granted, Hillary's facing she's putting a lot of the blame and probably more so than she should because there are other issues we're going to talk about in a minute. But that late in the game, when her numbers had gone down from 4 to 3 and then 2, which is well within the margin of error on these polls. In my opinion, it made a difference. I have to tell you though, Mark, I think one of the most, I'm not going to give this guy credit for being smart at all. Cause I think he's lucked his way into, finding the worst amongst us and talking to them in ways that rile them up. But I think the most important thing Donald Trump did to aid his campaign was to open his entire campaign with this notion of we are too politically correct. His whole anti-PC thing, in retrospect, was a key that really unlocked a crazy amount of support for him from, I'm just going to say it, angry white voters.
White supremacists.
White supremacists. even those who may not consider themselves white supremacists, but who have these really negative opinions and about people of color and people who, and they perceive that the people who've benefited under the Obama administration are not them. It's the people of color who benefited, and you've left me behind.
And immigrants.
Exactly.
And.
Exactly. The and the and. Great story in the New Yorker that talks about this issue, how his use of this anti-PC commentary really created a great opportunity for feedback from these his supporters and the I'm going to say deplorables. I don't care that Hillary's backed off that statement because the things they're saying and doing are fucking deplorable. You know, is every Trump voter deplorable? No, but some of you need to evaluate your policy decision and your belief in your party versus a belief in the country because, yeah, I don't know. It's very frustrating to me. Along that same lines, Mark, do you remember after Obama's first election and then subsequently his second election, how the media were saying that it's the end of the Republican Party, there'll never be another Republican president?
Mm-hmm.
They were feeding that by the demographic shifts in states like Georgia and Texas and Arizona,
mm-hmm.
And saying that it's, my God, these states are going to go Democratic. And how do you think that played in? The speculation, knowing the psyche of this disenfranchised, angry, white American male.
Well, I think it's the last dying gasp of, white people have held power in this country for, since the founding of our country.
Yeah.
And if you look at it, statistically speaking, in the year 2040, white people will be a minority in this country. And so you have this what's been being called white lash by a lot of activists. The people of color activism saying, this is white lash. And it truly is, because here we have an ignoramus who has no experience in governing, connecting into the zeitgeist and the fear of white people losing power. And so this backlash
and stoking that fear.
And stoking that fear and making it, when the KKK has a parade in North Carolina celebrating the victory of Donald Trump, America has a problem with racism. And it's normalizing racism, and it's saying that racism is okay.
Yeah. And that normalization is something I'm very frightened of, because this notion that I'm all for the peaceful transition of power. The Electoral mm-hmm. College will vote on December the 19th. It doesn't seem likely that enough of them will change their mind to swing states. That would be unheard of. But there's a great article on Time that discusses that this is exactly why the Electoral College exists, to keep demagogues like Trump out of office.
Right.
And, I'm not hopeful, but
it's a long shot.
It's a long shot.
That's a very, very outlying, pie in the sky kind of thing. There's only been a couple of instances where the Electoral College, somebody has changed their vote, but it has never been enough to sway an election.
And you don't think the Brexit remorse?
No, because there are states, there are certain state laws in the United States that directly forbid any of those electorates from casting an opposite vote.
Well, what's the point in the Electoral College?
Exactly. Here we are back at the beginning.
I want to introduce another topic that I thought was absurd, but I think it may prove the prove its point, and that is there's an article from Inc. magazine that says that the title is "Why SNL Cost Hillary the Election," and the article goes on to discuss the smugness of the Hillary Clinton campaign. Let me read this to you. They didn't need the email scandals, the FBI, any of it. The constant smugness created by both the Hillary Clinton brand and the supporters of it, often intertwined. Note President Obama's quip that the only place he could see Trump deliver a State of the Union was on a Saturday Night Live skit. This became unbearable to the only group who could stop the election victory, so they did. I don't know that I buy in to the fact that Hillary's smugness lost her the campaign, or the promotion of Hillary. There's deep questions about journalists who were clearly biased toward Hillary. I question why that's a concern, given that she is vastly capable of the job. He is vastly incapable of the job. So I'm biased in that I think that's fine for them to be biased toward her. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have a job of telling the truth, and maybe that's part of the problem, is that they didn't call him out enough for exactly what he was. And this false sense of the need to be fair. He's the Republican candidate. He should get fair treatment. He should get fair treatment in being called exactly what he demonstrates that he is. A racist, right. Xenophobic, homophobic, no-nothing, you know? I don't know. Now, in some ways, am I proving their point? I'm so smug to think that smugness wasn't the issue. Mm-hmm. She did have some failings along this route.
Right.
She seceded the ground of the working man to this guy who lives in a gold-plated palace in the sky.
Right, who has them convinced he's for the little guy.
Now, I don't,
and he's not.
I don't know about you, but did you see the 60 Minutes interview last week with the whole family sitting in gold-plated chairs?
No, I could not bring myself to watch that. I'm still pretty much on lockdown as far as news goes, just because it's so upsetting how people can be duped by this guy. I have been looking at who he wants on his cabinet, and I'm like going, uh-huh, yeah, right. You know, you've got his chief strategist is a bigot and a racist.
Yep. White supremacist Bannon. The former head of Breitbart. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. With some of the most vile, divisive, anti-race commentary and headlines and print that we've seen in our nation's history. Yeah, no, sign him right up. Sure.
Yeah, yeah. So he's going to have the ear, and you've seen who his domestic policy dude is. It's ridiculous how people can think that Donald Trump is for the little guy and the guy who's in, what is it, West Virginia in coal country?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's going to bring back those jobs. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it was featured on the cold opening of Saturday Night Live last night. A character playing a guy from Grundy, Virginia, which is back in the hills where I'm from, a county over, albeit a county nearby, but still coal country. And, you know, Donald Trump is going to bring back our jobs and all of our jobs, right? And we know that's not going to happen because coal is too expensive to mine compared to natural gas. It is a dirtier source of energy. So when he guts the EPA, that will help in that regard. But I got news for you. Coal operators, major coal operators, are still switching to gas and fracking and all of that business because it's cheaper, right? And it's safer in their eyes than sending people, you know, a mile down in the earth. But you know, that's one of many promises he's made that mm-hmm. are not going to happen. He's promised to eliminate the 19 trillion federal debt in 8 years. He's promised to balance the budget without cutting Social Security and Medicare. We now know that's in question. You know, in addition to the bringing back the coal jobs, he's going to deport 12 million illegal immigrants. He's going to end birthright citizenship, grow the economy by 6%. He's going to eliminate the Department of Education and the EPA, rewrite the tax code, prosecute Hillary Clinton, make our allies pay for their share of security, rebuild America's roads and infrastructure for one third of the cost. Increase the he's going to achieve that by not paying the vendors. You know, we know that very well.
Mm-hmm.
Kill the relatives of terrorists. We heard this morning they're going to bring back waterboarding. We heard Mike Pence say that on the Sunday news shows this morning. And going to put an end to Wall Street reforms. What's not to love there? Give me a fucking break.
That's all in his first 100 days.
Yeah. Yeah. Make it happen. Give me a mm-hmm. break.
Okay, now, George, obviously we have rather strong opinions about this, and, you know, the next 4 years is going to be very difficult, and rather than try and point fingers and say what went wrong, we have to accept what we have in front of us. Is that right?
No. I'm sorry, yes, of course it is. We believe in the peaceful transition of power, even to a jackass.
And we want to spend a little bit of time about talking about what you can do.
You know,
and how important it is for you to remain engaged in this political democratic process for as long as we have it.
And we have to not make the mistake that the, quote, angry, disenfranchised voter who elected Trump. This is probably one of the aspects of this mess that drives me crazy. These people were angry because they supposedly were left out of economic reform, left out of growth. And I don't deny that they were. I take issue with what did you do to stop it. You kept electing Republicans and sending them to Congress who sat on their thumbs and did nothing. You stood in the way. No person, no president has ever acted with more concern for the average man, for people unemployed, for people about to lose their homes than President Obama did. He was elected at a time that the economy was perilously close to failure. Utter and complete bank failure. He had to make hard decisions, as did Bush on his way out the door, had to make hard decisions about bailouts. Some worked out well, a la the auto industry, right? I mean, give me a break.
Mm-hmm.
Detroit is on a resurgence. Not just the industry itself, but that city is on its way back. That would not have happened without President Obama's commitment. You know, federal jobs programs were presented to the degree that he could pass things without the Senate and the House, proposing mortgage relief, mortgage assistance programs to help people stay in their homes, despite the fact that, you know, banks were all too happy to foreclose on 5 million American homes. 5 million American homes were foreclosed in this process. And this is what chaps my ass. Nobody worked harder to help the average American, and yet, than the Democratic Party, and specifically President Obama. But we're to believe that Hillary doesn't care, that the party she's part of, who's been fighting so hard to bring the economy back on a larger scale for everyone, we don't care about the average man. That's where she failed. I will admit that her campaign failed in the ability to take control of that narrative, to propose and talk about the things that she had proposed, because she has continuing economic reform packages in her plan, but she didn't talk about them enough, and somehow she got derailed mm-hmm. by this Donald Trump nonsense, and she frankly should have been focusing on making it clear that Democrats are going to continue to find ways to improve the average lives of the average American. And now, because he was able to take that narrative and work it to his advantage and impact the disenfranchised, angry white voter and just slather that with racism and anti-political correctness and all this other stuff, voila.
Here we are.
Yeah, despite all that, you're right. We have to we have to not be those people. We have work to do.
Mm-hmm.
I plan to be vocal. That's what worries me most, Mark, mm-hmm. is people being silent. Well, we'll deal with
right.
it. We'll deal with it in 4 years. There is a lot on the line here. A lot. Mm-hmm. We're talking about LGBT values. We're talking about women's reproductive values. We're talking about the Supreme Court. We're talking about entitlements. We're talking about the very health care that 20 million Americans have now that wouldn't that will go away if they abolish Obamacare. And when they and they're not going to come back with something better. They're not going to, quote, improve it or replace it. They're going to go back to the same old system where people with pre-existing conditions are fucked and will die because you have pre-existing conditions. So that's what's at stake here. And to say nothing of all these conflict of interest, to the legal issues he's going to have because he's got all of these pending legal actions against him, we can't afford to be silent.
Mm-hmm. And this is going to be a marathon, George. It's not going to be a sprint.
Right.
So people, we are going to have to support each other. We're going to have to take care of ourselves and each other so we have the resources and the strength to carry on what the work that needs to be done. And one of the things that I've been really struck with since the election happened is, you know, all of these people who are fearful, those people of color or who have immigration status that, you know, they're fearful that, you know, they're going to be deported or they're not going to be protected. And we've already seen a rise in hate crimes since Donald Trump has won the election. And one of the things that that struck me, and I'm going to be 50 this year, and I've been involved in politics and voting since I was 18 and prior to that. We have to get educated on how our democracy works. We have to be engaged. Now, as GLBT people, we have the experience. We've been organizing for decades. When I woke up on Wednesday after the election, I was devastated. I was depressed. And then I decided, okay, I need to take a step back. I need to get some perspective and some clarity here. And so I kind of stepped back and decided to take care of myself. I went to bed early. And I woke up angry on Thursday morning, not the anger that is out there that says, you know, we can't do this. This is a determined, slow burn anger. And I have made the decision, and I was coming out in an era that it was not safe to be out. But you know what we did? We looked over our shoulder. We took care of each other and we started to organize. And I keep coming back to the ACT UP with AIDS awareness and HIV. And you know what? We need to go back to that playbook.
Yep.
There has to be civil disobedience. There has to be protest. But most of all, we have to get organized. We have to put resources towards those organizations that are going to challenge this president, like the ACLU and the Southern Poverty Law Center. Those are two organizations that are going to be key and pivotal as we go forward. So we have to be engaged, and it's going to start at the local level. You have to start with your local representatives. You have to make the phone calls. You have to write the letters, and you have to take care of yourself so you have the energy to move forward.
Well said. You need to continue to educate yourself. Please use as a reliable and multiple news source and use your critical thinking to understand as much of the issue as you can. This is not the time to be lazy. We all can be grow tired. You know, we've all grown tiresome of this nonsense. Unfortunately, we don't have the luxury of being tired. We have to educate ourselves. We have to understand as much about the policies as we can as they're coming out. We have to be vocal. You have to support that on a grassroots level locally. You have to do it on your own when there's no grassroots network afforded to you. You need to support the big players on the national scene. That's the ACLU, HRC. Your state has LGBT equality. And by the way, we're not just talking about LGBT here. We're talking about all these issues. We're talking about immigration. We're talking about women's rights. We're talking about protecting fairness on the Supreme Court. We're talking about every single issue that's going to come up. I mean, waterboarding.
Exactly.
Really? Waterboarding? It's clearly a violation of the Geneva Convention. We have to speak up about that. You need to know who on your... And by the way, Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, not all these Republicans are real thrilled with him.
No, they're not.
So some
there
of these,
are allies there. We some, just need to find them.
Especially on the topics. John McCain is not going to be thrilled about waterboarding.
No.
Right? So if you're in Arizona and you're hearing our voice... get to writing some emails and making some phone calls to John McCain, you know, and have your friends do the same. It's gonna take a lot of work to keep the pressure on, to hold him accountable. Mark, I'm not sure how, and this is particularly concerning to me because I work in media, so I have to be careful about how I engage media, because these are people that I communicate with as part of my job. But on the sort of large scale, how do we hold media accountable for their coverage or lack thereof?
You know, I hate to say it, but we're going to have to start paying for quality journalism. And like, it isn't cheap.
Yeah, ProPublica. You know,
I've worked in the media before as well, especially when it comes to public broadcasting, and it's not cheap.
Right.
And so you're going to have to get that subscription to the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or the New York Times. But, you know, what you have to do is you have to discern where your news is coming from. I'm sorry, but BuzzFeed should give you a big red flag.
Yeah.
You know, and you need to question what you're consuming.
Well, and
is it correct?
And even weigh them. I mean, the Wall Street Journal is a great example. Wall Street Journal doesn't exist for the common man.
No.
Wall Street Journal exists for Wall Street and corporations and the wealthy. So we're not saying dismiss what you read in the Wall Street. You need to read the Wall Street Journal to understand what they, but you weigh it with the audience they represent and the voices and the messages they try to, I mean, that there's value in what you read in the Wall Street Journal. You just take it in context with the other sources who are talking about the same issues.
There is inherent bias in everything that you read, regardless of where it is coming from. You have to be savvy enough in order to spot that, while at the same time cross-referencing across these ideological divides in order to find out, is this fact correct? And that's going to take work. It's not going to be your little BuzzFeed or your Huffington Post, 500-word article that's going to get this to you. You're going to have to spend some time.
Absolutely. People are already talking about the two-year election.
Yeah, the midterm election.
The midterm election. Where Obama in his first term lost the House and the Senate, right? Did he lose both? I think he lost both. People are already assuming that will happen. That does not happen without your support of your Democratic candidates.
That's right.
Now. I mean, it's not going to happen without you understanding who they are, encouraging them, supporting them financially, helping get the vote out, helping get the message out, and that all that has to happen now. So to recap, you got to understand the issues. You got, and I'm doing this as much for my own self edification here too, kids. I'm not preaching to you. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm having to sort of ramp up my own understanding and my own game plan about what I'm going to do, how I'm going to do. Yeah, I'm going to bitch about things, but I'm also going to act to the degree that I can. So this is about educating ourselves. This is about knowing who's making what committee, what senator. Who makes these decisions? How can you best impact them? If you don't like waterboarding, you got to talk to John McCain. Who else is on the Foreign Services Committee? What are the right committees to be approaching? Does that committee chair reside in your state and thus would be more responsive to your email? Are you a constituent? Calls matter. Emails matter. Don't let anybody tell you they don't, because when they happen in volume enough, it is an indicator of a groundswell of movement. And we just have to be more on it in the next, certainly the next 2 years. I worry, sometimes because I don't know who's coming up the Democratic pipeline. But then I'm reminded I didn't know who the hell Bill Clinton was.
Right.
Before his campaign, and I sure as hell didn't know who Barack Obama was before his campaign. So right. Don't assume because there aren't rising stars. There's a lot of promise out there. Julian Castro, who's the current HUD secretary, is promising from, I think he's a former mayor of San Antonio, if I'm not mistaken. There is hope. There is hope. You have to dig in there, and the media is not going to deliver to you hope. You're going to have to dig, read, research, find who you like, and encourage their campaigns. What are we leaving out? What else can folks do, Mark?
I read an article about somebody who was involved in politics, and in order to get your voice heard, start at your state offices, not the national office. Go ahead and contact your national representative, but do so through their state office because they have a direct line to the representative and they're checking in. They understand the pulse of what's going on. You're going to have a much greater influence starting on the state level than you are if you go on the national level.
You're saying call your local constituent office, not the DC office.
Not the DC office. Every House of Representative and every senator has a state office. Do not hesitate to call them. And, I'm an introvert. I hate doing it by phone, but it's been proven time and time again. It's those calls that are going to inform your representative of what's happening.
Yeah. Oy.
Yeah.
Mark, I think we're just under an hour, so we should probably end.
Yeah, this is a little bit longer episode than normal, but we kind of wanted to have it be useful and to kind of really flesh out the entire picture.
What went wrong and what do we do moving forward? I do think it's important to look at what went wrong because I don't think it's just about
right, because we don't want to repeat the same mistake.
Exactly. Always something to learn. Folks, thank you so much. We apologize for the delay. That was largely on me. Work has been probably some of the busiest I've been in the last several years, and also sort of fell into a bit of podcast malaise. but Mark's been kind enough to hang in there. So we look forward. We have a lot to talk about in the year and years ahead. No shortage of these and other topics.
Exactly.
All right, folks, that'll do it. Mark, thank you so much. Stay warm.
Stay engaged. All right. We'll talk to you soon, George.
Take care.
You too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The North and South of Things. More information available at northandsouthofthings.com. Follow Mark on Twitter at Laughing Buddha. That's LaffingBuddha. And George at George in Atlanta. Our podcast theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.
This show is part of the Pride 48 Network. Find more shows over at pride48.com.